Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, March 24th. Happy Saturday to you across the internet world of podcasting here in North America. But, you know, over the years, I've met a lot of nice people, a lot of very interesting people. By Facebook, on the internet, and many of them we've had on the show many times. Leslie Eastman, Barry Jacobson, Barry Castleman, Bill Katz. I mean, lots and lots of them that we've met over the years. Well, today we're going to meet one of the most interesting people that I've met through Facebook and social media, and that's my friend Bruce, who is an author as well as one of the most interesting people that I've ever chatted with. In fact, we often spend many, many moments on Facebook, exchanging a little bit of our wisdom back and forth. So let me say hello to my friend Bruce, who's in New Mexico. How are you, Bruce?
Hello, Silvio. Thanks for having me on.
You know, it's my pleasure. As I said in the introduction, you're really an interesting guy, and always wanted to have a chat with you. We've had a few chats before, but today we're going to take a little bit more time and kind of talk a little bit about your books and some of the characters in your book, and then go back and forth a little bit on this Facebook experience that you and I had, as well, obviously, the controversies around the world. But how's everything in New Mexico today?
Well, today it's a little windy, and it's hot, and I haven't had my AC service yet, so I'm living without air conditioning. But I grew up without air conditioning, so it's okay. You know, I can hack it.
Well, I'm sure you can manage. I mean, thousands of years without air conditioning, and people did just great. So I'm sure you can work it out. We do get spoiled, though, I have to admit. We do get spoiled, especially here in the Southwest. Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about some of your books and some of the characters that you've created in your books. But I want to begin by going back and remembering some really interesting people who were born on this day in history. And I thought some of these you might have a few things to say about them. So let me begin. 1874, a fellow by the name of Harry Houdini was born in Hungary. He ended up in New York later, became probably the definition of the modern magician. You know, one of my nieces is married to a professional magician, and he speaks very well of Houdini. He regards Houdini as like the example to many magicians. So anything come to your head, Bruce, when you hear Houdini?
Well, Houdini, the thing that I admire him for is that he debunked fake spiritualists as frauds. And that was quite a controversy back then. And I always thought that was interesting because he was portrayed as a fraud many times, but I don't think they ever proved he did anything fraudulent. And the other thing was the thing that brought about his death is appendicitis and allowing himself to be struck in the abdomen.
Hmm. Interesting. Yes. And there are many movies of Houdini. In fact, recently there was a television series. There was a Tony Curtis movie in the 1950s about his life. And, you know, that's kind of a clean version, Hollywood version of the time. But I still thought it was a pretty good movie. I thought Tony Curtis did a great job of playing Houdini in that movie. So that's how I was introduced to Houdini, by watching that Tony Curtis film. That was the first time I had actually heard of Houdini. So that would have been probably when I was a kid in the 60s that I heard about Houdini because of that movie, Bruce.
You know, I remember that movie. I hadn't thought of that. And then when I think of Tony Curtis, I think of him and Taras Bulba with Yul Brynner about the Poles and the Cossacks fighting for the steppes. And they had this stupid romance he had with, Tony Curtis, the Cossack, with this woman who was a daughter of a Polish general or nobleman or something. It was just sophomoric. And then, you're right, when I go back to Tony Curtis of Houdini, that was actually a pretty good movie.
Well, I would recommend it. I mean, I would really recommend it to anybody who wants to get a quick, you know, two-hour biography of Houdini. It's not really heavy, not a heavy movie. It's not as heavy as the recent television show that they had. They had a series of shows. I think it was on PBS about Houdini. I think it was PBS. This may have been 10 years ago. And it was pretty heavy. That series was heavy. I mean, by heavy, I mean you really saw maybe some of the darker side of Houdini. But the Tony Curtis movie is entertaining on top of that. Plus, his wife is played by Janet Leigh, who was a pretty attractive lady in her time. So that movie, Houdini, Tony Curtis, I would recommend that. But I, you know, my niece is married to a magician, professional magician there in New York City. He does shows. And I tell you, he talks about Houdini all the time. He said he's the inspiration for the modern magician, Bruce.
Houdini still has a following. Is not there still a seance every Halloween that they try to contact Harry Houdini?
They may do that. I'm not familiar with that. But now here's another personality who was born on this day. This guy is pretty consequential considering he only lived 25 years. Clyde Barrow of Bonnie and Clyde. And he was actually born in the Dallas area, and he's buried here. He and Bonnie are buried here. And there again, I have to confess, I was introduced to them by another movie, this one by Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. Remember that great movie they made? I think is in the late 60s also. And that's how I got introduced
to
Bonnie.
Yeah, I remember
Clyde.
I grew up with stories of Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde and Charles Starkweather were the two vile, the bad guys that had terrorized the Midwest at one time.
Wow. Well, around here, I read up a little bit about Bonnie and Clyde here recently, because there was another movie that came out in 2013 it was a television movie, pretty interesting movie that came out. And I found out that after they were killed in 1934, there was like almost like a 30-year period where nobody talked about them. Nobody wanted to remember them. Their family especially didn't want to be bothered with questions about them. So they kind of shut down. I mean, they literally buried the topic. And it wasn't until that movie with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway that it all kind of came back. Now, of course, the movie glamorized Bonnie and Clyde to some extent, which, you know, you always have to think of them. You have to remember they kill people. So, you know, you have to balance it, I guess, Bruce.
Well, I remember when I watched Bonnie and Clyde in the theater. I don't know what year that movie came out, 70 or 69 or something.
Yeah, it was in that time frame, late 60s, yeah.
I didn't have the term gratuitous violence in my vocabulary then, but I thought that, you know, they sure are killing a lot of people to embellish the legend of these two people, because I'd heard of them all my life, or as a kid, you know. Bonnie and Clyde were here. Out here, it's Billy the Kid slept here, you know, but Bonnie and Clyde were there. And I remember, I don't know if they actually killed that many people. I think they killed 8 or 9 law enforcement officials or officers, and I don't know how many civilians were killed, but they killed quite a few people.
Yeah, I don't think they killed that many civilians on purpose. It wasn't like they were gunning for civilians, but obviously sometimes civilians got caught up in the crossfire. But yes, you're right. They did kill policemen, and that leads me to the end of their lives when they were, you know, when they're ambushed by that police force. And later, I remember reading, they asked one of the police officers who shot at them that day to kill them. And they asked the question, like, wasn't that a bit of overkill, a bit too much? I mean, did you have to put 300 bullets in their car? And they said, well, you know, we don't like people who kill cops. So I think there was a vengeance, I would think, in that action there to kill Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, but you can understand it, Bruce. I mean, they kill some of your buddies, you get pretty angry. You want to take it, you know, you want to take it out on the people who killed your buddies, Bruce.
Well, one of the legends from Texas is a guy named Hamer, not Hammer, but Hamer. And he was the Texas Ranger that they brought out of retirement to put together a crew to hunt down Bonnie and Clyde. And I think, didn't they get him outside of Shreveport somewhere, some little town?
They got him in Louisiana. They actually got him. They were going to see somebody at a farm. And I don't know the exact connection, but the person at the farm basically betrayed them or called the cops and said they're going to be here. So they were at the end, you know, they were turned in by one of their friends or something. But, I mean, they had no chance. Yeah, you can call it
that. This Texas Ranger is a legend in Texas.
Yes, he is. He is. And but I mean, once they walked into that ambush, they didn't have a chance. I mean, because they were, I don't know how many police officers were there, but there were enough there to make Bonnie and Clyde never had a chance. Well, here's another character who was born on this day in 1930, Steve McQueen. And there again, movie. Now, there again, I saw the movie, The Great Escape. And that's when I was introduced to him in that great motorcycle scene. So here's a real character, too. I mean, he made movies. Actually, I think his best movie was The Cincinnati Kid. But, you know, he made a few good movies. So I don't know if we can even call one his best movie. I think The Great Escape, though, was probably the one that sticks in my head, Bruce.
Well, from my reading on Steve McQueen, and Al Pacino said the same thing, Steve McQueen was the first anti-hero in cinema, Hollywood cinema, because people say it was Michael Corleone and The Godfather. And Al Pacino, and I agree, had said, no, it was Steve McQueen, no matter what role he played. You know, I mean, in Bullet, he was great. Mm-hmm. He didn't do that much of the driving in the famous car chase. And another guy, a friend of his, John Elkins or something, actually did the driving. John Elkins also did the motorcycle jump in The Great Escape. But McQueen was, he just had a way of taking over the screen. I remember reading that, what was the one, The Magnificent Seven? Is that the one with Yul Brynner and everybody?
Yeah, that was another one.
Okay. McQueen would always be doing something in the background, like shaking a shotgun shell or playing with his gun or adjusting his hat behind Yul Brynner, and it pissed Yul Brynner off. Because it distracted the audience, Yul Brynner, back to what Steve McQueen doing.
That's right. That's well, especially at that time when Brynner was on top of the world, I would think. In terms, more people went to see Brynner than Steve McQueen, I would think. Time. But you know, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say McQueen starred with Dustin Hoffman in Papillon.
That's right. That's a good movie,
and
too.
That's a good movie, too. Yeah, I went to see you get some history from movies like that, because I had no idea that French had these prison colonies where they just dropped these guys off, you know?
Right. Well, that's right. And that was actually a French book. That was actually a novel, a French novel, the book. And the book was also translated into Spanish and I'm sure English as well, but these island prisons that the French had, you know, that's the movie Les Misérables. That's where they had a similar story where they would drop off these people. You know, the Count of Monte Cristo, the same thing. They would drop off these people in these prisons, islands, and, you know, it was very difficult to escape from these places. I mean, you probably didn't have any chance to escape if you got into the water, because you probably would just drown you're so far from anything, you couldn't swim to anything, Bruce. I mean, you're probably 40 or 50 miles away from anywhere. So you had to get lucky and get picked up by somebody or just get lucky to survive, Bruce.
In the movie, didn't they show his character as an old man back in France?
Maybe so. I'm going to have to watch that again. But but I do remember when he died. He was only 50 years old when he died. And I remember watching the news. I don't remember exactly what he died of, but it was sudden. Whatever it was pretty sudden. And
he died in Mexico.
Oh, he did? Okay. But he was in Mexico when he died. Now, I don't know if he went to Mexico just to pass time or whether he was there to get medical treatment. That part I don't know.
Well, do you know the first movie he starred in? It was a B movie.
Which one?
The Blob.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah, I remember that movie. That was your classic 1 o'clock in the morning science fiction movie that we would get when we were in school. You know, you stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning to watch these movies, and these movies. Oh yeah, The Blob was one of them, and all these other those kinds of movies like that. Well, you know, I mentioned these characters because they're interesting characters, but kind of takes me to your books and some of the characters that you've written about. Why don't you give us a little summary of your book catalog? I have a link to your Amazon page on the show information, but talk a little bit about, I think you've got three or four. Why don't you talk a little bit about them?
Well, I've got four books, and I'll start with the newest book first and then go backwards. How's that sound?
Sure, go ahead. Great, that sounds great.
I've got a novella on there. It's 51 pages called Tularosa Reckoning, and I wanted to challenge myself to write an entire story in less than 50 pages. So I have 51 pages, you know, and it's a story about a half Indian, he's half Lakota, half French train robber who decides to quit robbing trains in some mysterious force. I never explain it. He leaves his gang on the plains of Nebraska after a catastrophic train robbery. That really wasn't his fault. And the train wrecks. Many people are killed. So he leaves his gang, and he wanders for about a year, and he ends up in Roswell, New Mexico. And he immediately gets in a gunfight there, kills a guy. It turns out he's a lightning draw. And he goes on, and he meets other characters. A cowboy on the run from El Paso, a guy named Omaha Pugs. These are characters I created. He eventually falls in love with Willow, an Apache maiden who seeks revenge on an outlaw called the King. And the story comes together, and the King is killed. And I'm writing a screenplay for this. But
wow.
The main character, and I'm lousy at screenplays, I got to get this under my belt. Anyway, the main character, whose name is Ruby, a friend of mine who's an actor, he's been in some pretty good shows. He's in The Deuce and a few others. He's got some movies coming up. In fact, I was supposed to be back in Asbury Park, New Jersey this weekend for this actor screenshot and a thing on screenwriting, but I decided not to go because of the weather, because I've been, you know, spent overnights in Newark Airport. You know what I'm saying? It's not the best place.
No.
Anyway, Ruby was written with a particular actor in mind. This guy can do it, you know. Willow is the love interest, the protagonist's love interest. She's got a revenge for this guy, this outlaw called the King. The King is simply based on ego. The King is a compilation of all these guys that could have been alive in the West at the time, from the railroad barons, you know, from the railroads where we get our act. When we get our federal laws of commerce, because the railroads are so crooked, you know, to Indian agents, to whatever. At the time, the Wild West was wide open for exploitation. And the other characters are just, you know, the kind of comedic relief sidekicks that I've always seen in Westerns, from Gabby Hayes to, what was Pat's name? Roy Rogers. Pat.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I can't. Yeah, no, I know who you're talking about. I can't think of the name right now, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, and so I had to throw a few of those in. And then I'm writing some strong female characters. I have a character in there called Beef Patsy, who's a woman who ranches by herself on the Tularosa Basin. Tough as nails, you know, and I got
you know
it all in to 51 pages.
You know who would be really good to play that role of the lady rancher? What was that lady in the television show, The Big Valley? What was that lady who ran that
Barbara
ranch?
Stanwyck.
There you go. That's the lady I think. Of course, she's dead now, but I'm just saying. Whenever I think of a strong lady in the Old West, of a tough lady in the Old West, that's the one that comes to mind. You know, because she made a few movies like that. I mean, that was not the first time she was in a Western. I've seen her in several Westerns where she's a tough lady out there in the West. So. When you were talking about that lady rancher, that's who immediately came to my mind. Barbara Stanwyck or Stanwyck? Yeah, that's who came to my mind.
And Pat,
so how do you do that
really
in 50 pages, Bruce? How do you do that in 50 pages?
What?
I mean, how do you do that story in 50 pages? That's pretty. I mean, that's very ambitious to write it in 50 pages. That takes a lot of talent to tell a story that complex in 50 pages, Bruce?
Well, you know that I'm a graduate of the Academy of Intellectual Fieism.
You're just a very talented
guy. I don't know. It took about a month. I had to go to the library. I still go to libraries and research the Old West. The only thing I knew about the Old West is what I knew or learned from movies. I didn't know how these guys really lived. And where I live, they have an excellent selection of old books about the Old West written by the guys themselves or their daughters or granddaughters. And so it's as historically accurate as I can make it. And then I just kept it to the dialogue, the action scenes. You know, it's kind of like the arc. You know, you start out, here's your arc, and then it goes down. I have a section in that book about White Oaks, New Mexico, which is a ghost town now, but it was a happening thing, you know.
Wow, amazing, amazing. Well, let me do this, Bruce. Let me take a little break. I want to take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our friend Bruce. We're going to get into a few more of his books and just learn more. I mean, it's just a fascinating guy to talk to, as you could see. But right now, I want to tell you about another good friend of mine, and he's Carlos Geddes. And, you know, we play his music on the show. Carlos was originally born in Venezuela, and he plays all over Dallas. I mean, this guy is all over the restaurants here in Dallas. So when you go out to eat, take your wife out to eat, take your girlfriend out to eat, lots of nice places around here. He's the background music. He's the guy in the background with a harp, giving you that romantic atmosphere for your evening. So go to his Facebook page and check out Carlos Geddes, and there you will get the schedule of everywhere he's at. He's in quite a lot of places around Dallas, particularly on Friday, Saturdays, and Sunday afternoons. And check him out. And if you do, tell him that I said hello. He's really a great guy. He and his wife, Luisa, are just absolutely great people. They're originally from Venezuela, and they've been living here in the Dallas area for some time. Let's get back to our friend, Bruce. Okay, so we got your shore story done, Bruce. What are the other ones?
Okay, the next one is called A New Mexico Ghost Story.
Now, this is the last one, right? Or is this not the last one? The previous is the last, right? This is the last or the previous?
This is the previous.
I mean, this is not your last.
Actually,
that's what I thought, yeah. That's what I thought, yeah.
Tularosa, you just told Reckoning, them. And...
That's the last one. Right? The Reckoning is the last one, right? That's the last one.
Yeah,
so now we
came out at the same time.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, tell me about this one.
Okay, this takes place, an Italian-American starts out in South Omaha, Nebraska. No, actually, it starts out in Napoli. A lot of history in this book. Naples, Italy, okay? And the his mother and father's immigration on a steamer from Naples to Italian Harlem in New York and eventually to South Omaha. And that was very well researched, and it was fun doing that part. They give birth to a boy named Vito. Vito grows up, and I chronicle his growing up and who else grew up in that neighborhood, South Omaha. In that one neighborhood, Marlon Brando, Henry Fonda, Gerald Ford, you know, and of course my character grew up in South Omaha. We're from South Omaha.
Right.
He develops an interest in rocketry, gets a job during World War II with the Army in Wichita Airfield, which was a happening place during World War II, a very historic place, as an electrical engineer. And he develops this theory of rocketry that could be used for the military. And he gives it to the Army. They make me whisk him away because no one can know about this, to the secret facility in New Mexico called the White Sands Weather Balloon Facility. But actually, it was where they were testing weapons and stuff like that. And it's still there. It's called the White Sands Missile Range now. He develops these rockets, and the Germans always had saboteurs everywhere. They sense something is going on at White Sands, and so they send the beautiful assassin to kill Vito. She's from Uruguay. She was influenced by the Nazi youth movement, Chile. Okay,
Uruguay, that's great. So she's from Uruguay. That's fabulous. That's a great place to pick a person from.
Oh, my God, the history of Uruguay and South America during World War II? People should
know.
You know what I'm saying?
I know. In fact, if I could just sidestep for a quick second. In one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, the guy who was his nemesis, I can't think of his name right now, but he thought that he had been shot, and the guy showed up in Uruguay. So Uruguay seems to be in lots and lots of stories. Anyway, back to your story. Can I say something real fast, though, before I forget? Because
sure.
It'll fit into your story. You mentioned the people who were born in that neighborhood, Gerald Ford. I'm assuming you're talking about the 38th president of the United States, who was born in Omaha,
yes,
Nebraska, by a different name. A lot of people may not know this. His birth name was Leslie King, Leslie Lynch King, K-I-N-G, and that was
the
name of his biological father, who left the mother when the baby was maybe a year old, less than that. He walked away and left the baby and the mom by themselves, and then the mom eventually moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where she met a doctor by the name of Gerald Ford. And then he eventually adopted the young boy, gave him his name. And so, you know, this incredible life, this young man, through the most unusual way that we have, becomes president of the United States after the resignation of President Nixon. So talk about an interesting character. I read a biography of Gerald Ford. I was always fascinated by his story. And he wrote a great biography after he left the White House. And in that biography, he tells the story. He was a young man. He was a very handsome young guy. This guy was used to do modeling in magazines back then. That's how handsome he was. And he was also a great athlete at the University of Michigan, played football. Many people thought he would become an NFL player. He was that good. But anyway, one day he's working at this place, and this man comes in and says, "Young man, are you Gerald Ford?" And he says, "Yes, I am." And he says, "Well, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Leslie King, your father." So anyway, that's how he met his father. And his mom told him the story because he was too young to know when his father left. So it's just another fascinating story. I just wanted to put that in because when you mentioned Gerald Ford, I mean, that's a great story in itself, Bruce.
I didn't know that about, well, I knew that he had his name changed, but I didn't know that he met his biological father. But anyway, I must clarify for the sake of demographics that Omaha and South Omaha are two separate cities. South Omaha was started by some Scottish nobleman, I forget his name, who reneged on financing the city, so they called it South Omaha. And it's a wonderful ethnic blend of immigrants. You know, it's just a great place. They had Sokol Hall in South Omaha, which was the Polish version of the YMCA for development of young people. Have you heard of Sokol Hall?
No, I haven't, but I was going to tell you how the first time I heard about Omaha, but I'll let you tell your story first because of my very first reference to the word Omaha. Tell your story, and then I'll tell you how I first heard about Omaha.
Well, Omaha is different from South Omaha. It's just two different cities, basically,
right,
is what I'm trying to get at. South Omaha had a great Little Italy, and Omaha had great Italian restaurants, great steakhouses, and it's still a great neighborhood. I mean, it has its problems with crime, among different demographics. Most cities do. But Omaha's a nice place. Winters are brutal. Summers are hot and humid. But it's green. There's water. There's the Missouri River. They built a pedestrian bridge across the Missouri River to Council. I grew up in a neighborhood called Westgate, which is a great place to grow up. You know? I think we moved there in 57. Anyway, what's your story about Omaha?
Well, my story is that there was a rock band in the late 60s called Omaha. And they were not very well known, but they had a band. It was called Omaha. And I remember growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and listening to the early days of FM rock. Remember that when they used to have FM rock and they used to play albums?
The FM.
FM. That's right. Yeah, it was different. You know, the AM DJ would talk over the records, and he was a happy fellow, you know, and now the Monkees and Daydream Believer, you know, number one this week, that kind of thing. On the FM side, it was like, and now from their brand new album, the second track on their brand new album by Omaha. That way, kind of. So they were pretending to be like classical music, you know, like they do. So anyway, there was a band named Omaha. And I said, what in the world is Omaha? And then one of my friends said, well, that's Nebraska. What do you think? I said, you're exactly right, Nebraska, Omaha. So that's how the first time I ever heard the word Omaha. So anyway, just wanted to bring that into the conversation.
68. Was it 68? Moby Grape had a hit called Omaha.
Well, maybe that's what it was. Well, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's what it was. I'm sorry. Maybe that I misspoke. It was Moby Grape that had a song called Omaha. I misspoke. It was not the band, was not named Omaha. It was the song. So I misspoke. I didn't tell the story correctly, but you're right. That was Moby Grape and Omaha. I'm glad you corrected me, because that is the story. Not the one I told was incomplete. That's the one that the band Omaha. So, or the band Moby Grape and the song Omaha. So back to your story.
Okay. So anyway, there's a climactic ending at the Otero County Fairgrounds with the assassin, Vito, the man in the black suit. His name is Jackson. He's a federal guy that has to oversee all these guys. There's an English rocket scientist. There's a Jewish guy from the Bronx that is just, you know, I had so much fun writing that character because he has an opinion about anything. He doesn't light up. And then the local sheriff, who is a woman, tough as nails, and she settles the whole thing with the Winchester 44 caliber lever action.
That would be, what was that girl, the lady who played policewoman, what was her name? Angie Dickinson, wasn't it? No, but that, I'm sure that was not her. And you're...
Give me a date with Angie Dickinson.
Yes.
Anyway, I started this book in 2006, researching the history. I've got a whole library on World War II history, tangents of that. I mean, just I learned so much about World War II, up to it, during it, and after. I started in 2006, lost interest in it, started Omaha in the Time of Saints about the Mafia. And then last year, I went out to the shed. I've got one of these tough sheds out here with, you know, the boxes carefully, you know, labeled and sorted where I can't find anything. Found the original manuscript and the hard drive it was on, or the disc it was on, fired it up and finished it, and it just flowed out, you know?
Great. Super.
So sometimes I think you have to purge, do something else, and then it will come back. Okay, the book after that is Wild Indians, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say something real quick, but you're exactly right. Sometimes when you're right, because I remember when I wrote my book, I had a similar type of situation. I sat down to write it, and there was a time, I came to a point where I had to take a week off, because after a while, you know, you lose your ideas, and taking a week off and not doing anything sort of brings you back, you know, it sort of energizes you. It refills your tank. So I think you're right. I can see why that happened to you. So Little Indians, tell me about that one.
Wild Indians. The name of the book is Wild Indians.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, Wild Indians. Yes.
And the name Wild Indians comes from, I believe in the book, the Chicago mob refers to all the different little or the smaller families, organized crime families in the Midwest. And there's Omaha, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Chicago, but these are all Indian names, these cities. And they call them the Wild Indians because of the names of the cities. And one mob guy says to another, he says, well, what about Cleveland? Is that an Indian name? And the other mob guy goes, you never heard of the Cleveland Indians? You go, oh, yeah, you're right.
That's right. Well, I got to tell you a joke about the Cleveland Indians, and it's not mine. It actually came from this guy Miller. Remember the guy Miller who was on the Bill O'Reilly show? I can't think of his first name right now. The guy who's in the Bill O'Reilly show. And I can't think of his first name. Miller is his last name. The very funny guy who used to be on also on NFL Monday Night. You know who I'm talking about,
yeah,
Miller,
right?
Yeah,
California.
Yeah, I cannot think of his first name, but his last name is Miller. And he was always on the O'Reilly show and very funny guy. Recently, you've heard about Elizabeth Warren, right? And her statement that she had Indian blood or something. So this Miller, I wish I could remember his name, the other day said that the 1954's Cleveland Indians rotation, this is the team that went to the World Series, was, you know, number one, number two, number three, and Elizabeth Warren. That was a rotation of the Indians in 1954. I thought that was one of the best jokes I had ever heard my whole life, because I mean, she pretends to be an Indian, you know, and I just thought Miller really got that one. Who were the other guys on that? Bob Feller is the one that comes to my mind. Al Lopez was the other one, and whoever the other one was, plus Elizabeth Warren. That was the rotation. Dennis Miller. How can I forget? I mean, yes. What a funny guy he is. All right. So the guy has not heard about the Cleveland Indians. That's a great line, Bruce. I like that line a lot. Good line.
Yeah,
how did you come up with that one?
Yep. I just made it up.
That was a great
line. You know,
I like that.
In this book, there are characters that were cultural icons in the 60s, and one of them gets assassinated on scene or on stage by the mob. And the mob sets up a patsy and says, you know, do this deal, you'll be surrounded by friends, and we'll walk you right out. Of course, they don't, and he kills a cultural icon. You have to read the book to find out who I'm talking about in real life.
Right.
And
of course.
I really enjoyed that part, writing that book, and a few other things in there where I could get back at cultural icons. That, like, you get a rock star or a folk star. And let me tell you about my generational allegiance. Before you called, I was listening to Joan Baez. Beautiful voice.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know,
yes.
Didn't agree with their politics. But during the 60s, you get these rock stars that were anti-establishment, you know, anti-corporate, anti a number of things, but they lived in mansions. They're reeking in the bucks, you know?
Right.
And I always thought that was kind of hypocritical. Anyway, this one cultural icon gets whacked in Wild Indians. It's a shorter book because I wanted to get through the point, get it done, because me and my readers have short attention spans. So it's about 60 pages shorter than Omaha and the Time of Saints, which was the first book, which sets all this up.
Right. Well, you mentioned Joan Baez, and I like her music too a lot, but I don't like her politics. I'm with you on that. But I love you have to set aside 11 minutes of your life to listen to Sad Old Lady of the Lowlands. But if you can go through it and stick with it and actually follow the story, it's one of the best Bob Dylan songs ever, Sad Old Lady of the Lowlands. But you have to be patient and listen to the 11 minutes because, frankly, it is a bit monotonous. But it is a great story, Sad Old Lady of the Lowlands.
At the time, I was absorbing that music
well,
at that age, you know.
You know, I have to tell you something. Joan Baez recorded an album of Bob Dylan music in the late 60s, around 1970, I'll put it that way, around 1970, called Any Day Now. It was a double LP. You can get the CD now. And in that album, she sings nothing but Bob Dylan songs. Not the usual ones, but some of the lesser known ones. One Too Many Mornings is one of the ones I like. Also, Boots of Spanish Leather. I absolutely love that song. Boots of Spanish Leather. That is a fantastic song. But again, it's like these Bob Dylan songs, they were like a little story. And that's why I used to like them so much because, you know, Boots of Spanish Leather is about the couple that separates. I mean, not separate on purpose. They just separate because of circumstances. And they're writing each other letters. And you have to hear the whole song because it's fascinating how it ends. how it ends. But it's really a great song. So let me time is flying, and I did want to get to another topic, not about your books, but about the whole Facebook experience. You and I met through Facebook and have stayed friends and have grown as friends through Facebook. But Facebook is under a bit of a cloud right now. And I wrote a post a couple of days ago, and I appreciate your reading my posts. I really always appreciate your comments. And I said that I think Facebook is going to change quite a bit over the next year or so. And so that Facebook is never going to be the same as it was. And it wasn't meant as a critical thing, but it's just a fact. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to wonder about their privacy a lot more than before. And so I think it's going to change. Do you feel the same way, Bruce?
I do. The narrative in the media about Cambridge Analytica and the Trump people using data mining, Obama, I think, was the first politician to use Facebook for data mining. I mean, he did. That's a proven fact. I don't know if there's anyone behind him. The Clintons did not. And then when the other candidates saw what an advantage it was for data mining, they paid big bucks, which apparently Zuckerberg did not declare. And he declared, or didn't declare, some other income. So I think Facebook will be fractionated into what the rest of social media has fallen into, is what fits your political, your social, your whatever your demographic in life is. And then you'll pay for that.
Right. I agree with you. And what's interesting about, because I remember this whole thing quite well back in, at the end of 2012, after the campaign, when President Obama was reelected and defeated Governor Romney, I voted for Governor Romney. I was very disappointed, to tell you the truth, that Obama was reelected. And but as I began to read, I mean, all the articles back then at the end of the year and all of that were talking about what a great campaign the Obama people had run, because they had used technology differently than anybody else. Basically, they had gone into all of these social media places and connected with voters, not through politics, but through their interests. So if all of a sudden, let's say you, Bruce, are a fan of Bonnie and Clyde, for example, they would connect to you that way. They would introduce you Obama that way. Now, and so, you know, you weren't introduced to Obama as the president. You were introduced as him, as maybe another person who was interested in Bonnie and Clyde or whatever. And that was so successful that the Republicans say, hey, we got to get our act together. We got to follow this and get into this. So they did. They did. And by 2016, the Republicans were at the same level as the Democrats. But for a long time, people were praising the Obama reelection for what they did, Bruce. So you're right. It was Obama who did it first. Now, whether he paid or didn't pay, that part I'm not sure. But there's no question Zuckerberg wanted Obama to win. That I do know. No question about that.
Yeah. Well, what's going on today, there's these marches nationwide about Our Lives Matter or Don't Shoot Us or something. All these kids out there marching, taking the initiative, okay? What upsets me about this isn't their agenda, is that it wasn't until a predominantly white influential high school got shot up in this age, in this era of protest politically, since Trump was elected. This is anti-Trump, and it's political expediency at the death of these people. Nobody marched for the black youth killed in Chicago and other urban areas. And the stupid thing about this is, you know, that this is a generation raised on instant gratification. This thing is going to fractionate. It's going to fall apart, pretty much like the anti-war movement did in the 60s and 70s. Because when they'll become disillusioned when they don't get what they're looking for. They're not going to get it. And so now we're going to have offshoots of this. Pretty much it could go anything from, you know, we had the anti-war movement, we had the SDS, we had the Weathermen, we had the Black Panthers. Eventually we had the American Indian movement, we had La Raza. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, no, I mean, no, I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. In fact, I caught a little bit of the march today at lunchtime. And look, I was on Telemundo recently, and I was debating a lady who had been in a Democrat lady who had been in the Women's March here in Dallas. So I said to her, why do you call it the Women's March? Well, because it was women. And I said, it was not women. It was women, but only women who criticized Trump. Did I see any pro-woman Trump? No. Did I see any, let's say, anti-abortion women speak? No. So they call it the Women's March, but in fact, it's a selected part of the Women's March. And I think to some extent, this march today is the same way. I caught some of it today as well. And it's like, yeah, I mean, they're all basically saying the same thing about gun control. And you're exactly right about black-on-black crime. That is the biggest story. More people more young people are killed every weekend in Chicago. I mean, something like 50 or 60 this year, and nobody ever marches for that. There's not a single march against that. It's almost like people accept it. And you're right. The Democrats don't want to talk about black-on-black crime because I guess that spoils the narrative. They have to at least admit that it's happening in a Democrat city. But these teenagers in South Florida have become superstars. But I think you're right, Bruce. I think they're going to be disillusioned and pretty quickly because they're not going to get what they want. They're not going to get what
numbers,
they want at all.
Yeah, their numbers look impressive on television, or I haven't seen television, but some people on Facebook were talking about it. Their numbers are a drop in the bucket to legal gun owners, voters, conservative, independent voters that simply want this nonsense to go away. What more gun laws can you have except banning gun ownership completely? And that will never happen.
Right, exactly. And a new poll came out, NBC Wall Street Journal poll came out this last week that said that 58% of the people who participated in the poll say that guns make people safer. So, I mean, that I think right there speaks for the majority of people. 6 out of 10 people believe that a gun makes them safer. And so I think that's pretty much the end of this movement. But this movement, these kids are going to get a lot of attention because there's a lot of media people who will give them the attention. But I think eventually it'll fizzle. And, you know, it'll die like a lot of the other movements for a lot of different reasons. Well, Bruce, we're just about out of time here, my friend. I want to thank you for joining us. Anything else you wanted to say that we missed? We had a lot, and I wanted to make sure you got everything in.
I want to come to Dallas, go to a restaurant where Carlos is, and we'll resume this conversation. That sounds like the legitimate thing to do.
That sounds like the follow-up plan. That sounds like the follow-up plan to this show, and then you and I will have a wonderful dinner with Carlos. We'll sit down with Carlos for a while, and then after that, we'll do another show, and we'll share with people the wisdom that we exchanged in that lunch. How's that?
Cuba Libres.
Cuba Libre. That's it. Cuba Libre. Yeah. That's what we have to say over and over and over again and hope that it happens.
Well,
Bruce,
I appreciate
thank
your
you so
kind
much.
Interest, and I
My
value
pleasure,
our
Bruce.
Friendship.
I do, too. I've grown very fond of you over here the last couple of years as we exchange notes, and I've been meaning to do this show with you for some time. I'm glad we did, and I hope it's not the last one because I'm sure this is not your last book.
No, there's another one out there somewhere. Well, I'm doing screenplays now.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there's something new that will come up that you'll tell me about.
Actually, there is, and I'll tell you about it sometime.
All right. Well, let's do that, Bruce. And, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to close the show today with a little music for my friend Carlos. So I'll play this as we go. I want to thank you, Bruce, and I want to thank all of you for listening, especially all of Bruce's friends and Facebook. Isn't there a very nice lady in England, I think, one time that commented on something you and I were saying? Why don't we say hello to her? I forgot her name right now.
Marian.
I forgot her name. All right, there you go. Marian, if you're listening, hello from Texas. So if you're listening, I just remember.
Beautiful and talented Marian.
All right, there you go. So I just remember her one time we were talking about something, and she came into the conversation. As often happens in Facebook, people come in and share their thoughts, and I just remember her all of a sudden. All right, well, here's a little ending music for my friend Carlos. This is from the CD that he put out recently. Bruce, have a great day.
You too, Silvio. Thank you.
All right, very well. Very well. Well, thank you very much to you for listening. Thanks to my friend Bruce. And check out the link, his Facebook link, and as well as the Amazon link where he's got all his books. Check that out. And, I think you're going to enjoy it a great deal. Great guy, great story, great creative, imaginative kind of guy. I like people like that. They're fun to talk to. All right, have a great day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.